Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Rebecca Harrell Tickell's acting career began at a very young age. Growing up in Vermont, she performed in school plays directed by her mom. Then it was on to New York with the hope of being signed with a voiceover agent. But instead, Rebecca wound up with a starring role in the Christmas classic Prancer, featuring Sam Elliott, Abe Vigoda, Cloris Leachman, and Michael Constantine. She received a Young Artist Award nomination for Best Young Actress Starring in a Motion Picture. More movies and TV followed, including A Piece of Eden, Third Watch, and Della Ventura. In 2000, when she was 20, Rebecca moved from New York to L.A. and continued working in movies. But 7 years later, following her role in the horror film Sugar Creek, Rebecca bagged acting to pursue her dream of combining environmental activism, filmmaking, and production. Not too long after that, she met director Josh Tickell. They joined forces, their first project, Fuel, which explores alternative energy sources as a way to wean America off its dependence on foreign oil. It won the Sundance Audience Award for Best Documentary in 2008. In 2010, Rebecca and Josh tied the knot. Through their company, Green Planet Productions, they make movies that deliver powerful social messages by exploring an issue or a movement. The Big Fix examines the BP Gulf oil spill. Freedom focuses on alcohol fuel. Pump exposes our addiction to oil and investigates cheaper replacement fuel. Their latest documentary, Good Fortune, tells the rags-to-riches philanthropic story of Paul DeGioia, one of the world's most celebrated entrepreneurs. Good Fortune marks the first time the pair has made a film based on an individual. There's lots to talk about, so let's meet and get to know Rebecca. Welcome and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Sandy. Thanks for having me.
So let's take a trip down memory lane and travel back in time to Vermont. You've always felt comfortable on stage? Acting was a natural act for you growing up?
Oh, definitely. I lived in my imagination as a child, and I was always performing in my mind and performing for our company, and we would have parties, and I'd stand up and I'd sing and dance, and I'd invite all of my friends over, and we would put on performances and invite all of the neighbors to come over. Definitely, you know, entertaining and entertainment was something that I was very passionate about from a very early age, and it was definitely something I knew I wanted to do with my life.
Well, you were encouraged, obviously, by your mom, who was involved in the arts, correct?
Oh, my mother, she's a riot, and when she was younger, she used to be married to a famous rock star named Danny Hamilton, who wrote that song, "Don't Pull Your Love Out on Me, Baby." Then I think maybe that song. I actually think that song was about my mother and her bad temper. In fact, I think it was. And she grew up in Hollywood as well and hung out with the Beach Boys and was at their house when Charles Manson showed up. And
oh, my God.
Played cards with Cher and was hit on by Elvis and had an incredible time here. And she was an incredible dancer on the TV show Shindig. And so when I was young, you know, I think she had a lot of excitement because she saw that I also loved entertainment, but I think she saw that I had some raw talent that could go pretty far. And so she decided to take me down to New York and see if I could get a voiceover agent to do jingles for, you know, commercials, like you had said. But it turned into something much bigger than either she or I ever possibly could have imagined. And the next thing you know, we had Raffaella De Laurentiis, the producer of Dune and Conan the Barbarian and all these incredible films, who's Dino De Laurentiis' daughter, and the director of the film, John Hancock, who had done Bang the Drum Slowly and other films, showing up at our front door in Vermont. And apparently I already had the job, but we didn't know that. They were there to interview my parents to make sure that they weren't crazy stage parents. And sure enough, they passed the test. And so the next thing you know, I was on set in Indiana filming Prancer.
Well, how old were you when all of this happened?
I was 8 years old.
Oh, my God.
I was cast in Prancer. And I mean, for me, it was just like a dream come true. It was the best thing that ever could have happened. I just remember feeling like, you know, I felt like my whole life was going to change, and I couldn't have been more excited.
So what was that like, transforming yourself and living in New York City?
It was the best thing that ever happened. And actually, we didn't move to New York. I still lived in Vermont, but we went on set in Indiana. And, you know, I had no idea that I was going to end up working, you know, 20 hours a day, which is what ended up happening. They were very sort of relaxed with the child labor laws at that time. So I would come back from the set and I would, you know, sleep for 4 hours. I was so exhausted that when the hotel caught on fire, which it actually did, I slept through the fire and I woke up being dragged out of the hotel room by firemen, and I couldn't see anything. And I thought I was dreaming, but I was actually in the middle of a smoky hallway. And yeah, the producer, Rafaela, who is my mentor and whom I absolutely adore and love, she had been smoking a cigarette in bed, and the bed caught on fire. And so the whole hotel caught on fire. And fortunately, she was able to escape through the window. But yeah, that was definitely an exciting moment. And when I showed up in her office the next day, I ran in and I said, "Rafaela, did you see the fire last night?" And she was smoking a cigarette. And she said, "Darling, I started the fire." And I just remember how she exuded power and she exuded leadership. And she just had this way about her that everyone respected. And I was so impressed with her. And she really... she just treated me like her own daughter. She taught me how to hula dance, and she gave me her mother's diamond earrings. And I think that really put a seed in me for something that would come later, which is film producing. And actually, when I did come out to Hollywood, I did immediately come and find her, and I asked her if she would be my mentor. And so she's been extremely helpful to me as I have made that transition from being in front of the camera to being behind the camera. And, you know, I never could have imagined what Prancer would end up opening up for me in my life. I mean, it was a grueling experience in the process, something I am forever grateful for. I mean, I feel so lucky that that happened. And, you know, I kind of think that Prancer was the greatest thing I ever did in terms of acting. And it's hard to achieve that level of success when you're 9 years old.
No kidding.
Because there's only one place to go from there, and that's down. And that's certainly what I experienced. I mean, when I ended up doing these other TV shows and movies and came out to Hollywood, I got cast as, I did a lot of voiceover for horror movies, and I would get called to the Warner Brothers lot to do screaming sounds, voiceover for celebrities like Halle Berry and Penelope Cruz, and I would do their screaming and crying sounds. And I like to joke that I got really good at that because that was just a reflection of my experience in Hollywood when I got here. Because it just wasn't what I thought it was going to be. I mean, Prancer was everything I could have ever hoped for. But after that, you know, when I came out here, I was just cast as a victim in films or as eye candy in films. And, you know, what was great about Prancer was it was about magic. It was about the anything is possible. It was about family and being connected, and it really touched so many people's lives, and it brought families together. And I mean, people sit down together as a family and they still watch it now, you know, almost 30 years later, and it's something that brings them together. And these other films that I got cast in later on, they were not that. That wasn't what I signed up for. What I wanted to do, what I was passionate about, was to make movies that inspired people, to make movies that would change the world and make it a better place, that would touch people and rock them to their core. I mean, that's what I love about movies. I love watching movies and being so moved that afterwards I go out and I change my life. And that's the kind of thing that I wanted to be a part of. And that was definitely not what I found when I got to Hollywood.
Well, in other words, when you got to Hollywood and you stay there for a while, it was clear, listening to you, that the bloom was off the rose for you, that what you experienced here was not what you were experiencing there. So at some point, does it seem like it was a natural act for you? Where did this intense passion for environmental activism come from?
You know, I grew up in Vermont, and I grew up surrounded by 140 acres of pristine wildlife. I used to swim in the ponds and come out covered in leeches, and I didn't care. You know, I just pick them off. And I spent my childhood playing in the woods and building tunnels in the snow. And, you know, there's just something that changes a person when they grow up deeply connected to nature like that. Oh, and I remember my sister came home from college and she taught us about recycling. And so we had to go clean up the dump. You know, there was just sort of people were waking up around that time as I was growing up around the environment. I mean, of course, you know, it'd been happening since the 60s, since, you know, Rachel Carson sort of illuminated the environmental movement for a lot of people. But you know, for my family, it happened in the 90s. And I remember, it's funny enough, I remember sitting in my grandmother's room watching the Today Show, and I remember this guy came on TV, and he was driving the veggie van, a van that was powered by used cooking oil that he had turned into biodiesel that was far cleaner when it was burned in a car than gasoline or diesel.
Mm-hmm.
And he had made it himself. There had been, you know, nobody had gone to war to get that oil. And, you know, there hadn't been a giant military budget or tax budget spent to produce that oil. And I was 16 years old. I saw this guy and I was just like, wow, that's it. That's it. You know, that how ingenious that he had done this. And he had written this book that taught people how to make their own fuel. And I remember that just left such an impression on me. But I kind of put it in the back pocket because I had my own ambition, you know, and that was to get out of Vermont as soon as possible. And I made my way to California, not realizing at that time that basically I had already made the movie that was going to be my starring role. I didn't know until I came out to Hollywood and ended up in these horror movies that that wasn't going to be my path. And that was devastating. You know, it was so ingrained in who I was,
right,
and who I needed to be,
right,
was a movie star. That was, you know, when you're 9 years old and you're on the Today Show and you're on the Tonight Show and you're on Arsenio Hall Show and you get kind of lauded for being this great actress. That really does something to your psyche as a child. Because for me, what that meant was in order for me to be loved by people, I need to be a famous actress. Now, that's a really tough, you know, that's a tough act to follow.
No kidding.
Having, you know, being so high up at 9 years old and then, you know, having this pressure to reach that same level of success and to keep that going. And so, you know, I think, I'm not sure if Prancer was a fluke and, you know, that was just like that moment in time and that really worked for me. And then after that, you know, it turns out maybe I'm not such a great actress, or maybe it's just this like, my psyche of having all that pressure kind of kept me from being able to really be free and express myself. But whatever it was, it wasn't meant to be that I would be continuing acting. And I had to learn that the hard way. I had to come out here and just fail and, you know, get cast in these films that I wouldn't even watch in order to reach the conclusion that what I was really committed to was making films that would make the world a better place. And that's rare. You don't see a lot of films like that. Or if you do, they're like, oh, that's nice, but I don't really want to watch it. You know,
right,
I wanted to make movies,
right,
that people wanted to watch, that were just, you know, that shook the world. Yeah, I mean, I think I kind of threw in my hat after those, like, the fifth or sixth horror movie that I did. I was in this Clive Barker horror movie called, well, I'm not going to say the name because I don't want anyone to go and watch it.
Okay.
But anyway, I played a succubus, which sucked the soul and blood of men.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I was, at the end of the movie, I'm in the basement of this monastery, and I was giving birth to this giant squid-like creature that then tries to eat me, and I was strapped to this table all day with puppeteers underneath the table working this mechanical squid-like creature that I'm supposedly giving birth to. You know, this is back in 2000, before everything was CGI. They really did it in real life with these crazy little mechanical machines that they had built to sort of fit my body. So anyway, I'm strapped to this table. I'm covered in slime. I've got these giant black contact lenses in my eyes. And I just was thinking to myself, how did I get here? This is not it. This is not where I want to be. And that was really the moment for me where I knew that I was going to make a big change in my life. I mean, as an artist, you know, you get so, you take everything you do so personally, and, you know, it comes through you, and you're sort of like channeling the source when you're really doing something that's beautiful and wonderful. And that's not what I was doing. Instead, I was just dreading going to work every day. So I realized what I really loved and where I really could channel that thing that was my spark that I was so passionate about was making films that were going to have me feel connected deeply to nature, because that's what I loved, and films that were going to really inspire people.
So it was a logical thing for you to meet your husband. It was meant to be that you were going to connect on a professional and personal level with Josh Tickell.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just, I look back on it now and I can't even believe that it all happened this way. But I met my husband, kind of knew that I was interested in him right away. And he and I knew each other for a year and a half before I really got to know him and dated him and went to his house. And the first year and a half, we just knew each other and we had met doing some volunteer work and we were very good friends. And so he invited me over to his house and for a party with a bunch of our friends. And I went over there and parked in his backyard. Lo and behold, was the veggie van.
Oh, get out.
And I couldn't believe it. I remember just standing there looking at the veggie van thinking, my goodness, all this time I've known this guy and I've liked him immensely. And you know, I've respected him. I really didn't know what he did. I knew that he wrote books, but that was pretty much the extent of it. And I knew that he was working on a movie about something, but, you know, that was really wasn't the topic of our conversations. And so when I saw the veggie van parked there, he showed me a clip of the film, which became Fuel later. And it was really about his journey with a veggie van and how his mother had been sick growing up in Louisiana, surrounded by 150 petrochemical facilities in the area known as Cancer Alley.
Mm-hmm.
I was very crystal clear that whatever it took, I was going to help him make this movie and that was going to be a part of my future. And I told him that. I said, every free minute that I have, I will help you with this. And he said, I want every minute. And so, in the meantime, to sort of supplement my acting career, I had become a realtor, and I was doing really well. I was selling, you know, million-dollar fixer-uppers in Bel Air and Beverly Hills, and I had quickly gone from being a peon to being sort of a big deal at my real estate office, and I quit my job. I sold my house. I sold my car. Everyone thought I had lost my mind. I moved in with Josh, and I became a movie producer, and I had helped him. I raised over $1 million in those first few months with him. A couple months after, we got engaged and we lived together. You know, our first films, they really were personal for us on a deeply personal level. And Fuel was really upbeat and really inspiring, and it showed how we could get off of oil. And then the BP oil spill happened, and we found ourselves down in Louisiana, and then life and history sort of repeated itself for Josh because I got sick, exposed to all of those chemicals and the Corexit and the oil. And that was a really dark place for us. And it was a really dark place for me, a dark time for me, because I was full of optimism. And, you know, I just really believed that anything was possible. And after spending all that time in Louisiana and seeing how the whole BP oil spill unfolded and what that whole film is about, it's about corruption and greed. It's about how our government is ultimately controlled by money.
Mm-hmm.
And so Josh and I were both very depressed after we filmed The Big Fix. And then we made two more films. We made Freedom and Pump that sort of followed up to that issue. But I think he and I were clear that we didn't want to make a career. We loved making movies together, and we realized that we could make great movies together. And there's nothing harder than making documentaries, especially documentaries about the environment and oil specifically. I mean, how can you make four movies about oil? And
right,
how
right.
Defense? I mean, that's really sort of a Herculean task.
Good point.
But all through those films, we had met John Paul DeGioia. He had been a huge supporter of us. And so John Paul DeGioia, he founded Patron Tequila. He is the creator of Paul Mitchell hair care products and that whole hair empire. And he said, the world needs to see this movie. And so we were excited to get to meet him. I mean, of course, he was a billionaire and super powerful. And as documentary filmmakers, you know, you always need people like that in your life because, you know, little grants aren't going to get these big movies made.
For sure.
And so he became a contributor to our films and a giant supporter. John Paul, here he was, a billionaire, but he was constantly giving away his wealth. In fact, he joined the Giving Pledge, which is billionaires who have committed to giving half of their money away to different causes. And, you know, and he was just constantly showing up for us. And we really had to take a look at that, especially as you know, politics were sort of heating up. And we just saw that he was kind of the antithesis of what we were railing against in our films. And we thought maybe a more powerful way to help shift this situation as cause-based filmmaking, filmmakers, is to make a film about how it could be different. What if we showed somebody who is a billionaire is really committed to conscious capitalism, that's really committed to giving back, to helping communities, to helping to feed people, to helping, you know, restore impoverished areas, because that's what John Paul is, that's who he is. And what was even more interesting about him is that he came from nothing. He grew up in East LA. His mom, you know, couldn't afford to raise them, so they had to. He and his brother had to live in foster care.
Wow.
He was a part of a gang. He was living out of his car. He was homeless, and that was how he started. Paul Mitchell was homeless, living in his car.
Crazy.
The Paul Mitchell hair bottles are black and white, is because that's all they could afford. And so then he goes on to create this huge empire. But instead of sort of sitting high up on the hill in his castle, he's constantly giving back to people. He's helping homeless people get off the street. He's helping farmers in Appalachia grow food. He's just really an outstanding individual. And we thought it was worthy of telling his story, because not only was it incredibly interesting, but, you know, in an age where Trump is on television telling people that business people who aren't greedy are stupid, and that's an exact quote of his. Here we have John Paul DeJoria, who's kind of like the anti-Trump. He's somebody who shows that you can make a profit for yourself, but you can also help people along the way, and you can help restore the planet. And that was the kind of model that we wanted to put out there. And so Good Fortune was born. It's a great rags-to-riches story of a man who lived the American dream. His mother was from Greece, so he was a first-generation American. And his story is all of our story.
What's next for you guys?
We have three films in production right now.
Oh, wow.
We have a film called Kiss the Ground, and that's a film about how we can reverse climate change through soil regeneration. So basically with what we eat. So with the food choices that we're making, we're either going to be adding more carbon into the atmosphere or pulling carbon down into the ground.
Because
what most people don't know is that the majority of carbon in the atmosphere came from our soil through bad agriculture. So we've made a film about that, then that'll be coming out next year. And we have a film on millennials that's about young people and how they're inheriting this sort of dangerous world and how they're perfectly poised to transform the world. And then in April, Josh and I will be directing and producing our first narrative feature film that we wrote. So it's our first fiction film. And it's a story that's loosely based on events that happened at Standing Rock.
Can you give us a little more about that film?
At Thanksgiving last year, I was 8 months pregnant with our second child. And when Standing Rock was happening, I really felt the call to go there. But upon talking to friends, and we filmed the Lakota elder Chief Looking Horse, and he's the spiritual leader of the Sioux Nation. And upon speaking with the people we know there, they said, don't come because it's too dangerous for you to come because you're pregnant. And the worst thing that could happen for the people on the ground there would be that something happened to a pregnant woman. That would just really shut the whole thing down. So Josh ended up going for Thanksgiving, and I was following it very closely as it was happening. And he came home just really shifted. And we kind of took a look at that and what that experience was like for him and what that experience is like for everybody. And we had us take a look at all of our material possessions, because here were people that were living off of the land, who were native to this land. And as two people who sort of consider ourselves environmentalists, we looked around our house, and I mean, I was buying everything for the baby, you know, and we had this toddler, and we had sort of become part of that baby industrial complex. And the experience that Josh had at Standing Rock, what that left us with was a real curiosity that, what do we need? You know, what is important here? And so we wanted to find a way to tell that story. And it would be a great opportunity for us to step away from documentary filmmaking and reach a wider audience, because more people watch narrative films than watch documentaries, and tell a story sort of loosely based on events there. So we wrote a script with a friend of ours about a man who was a war veteran journalist who was having PTSD and struggling with PTSD and couldn't finish the book that he was writing on PTSD because he still had PTSD, and ends up going to cover events at Standing Rock to make money for his pregnant wife and their family, to cover the other side for the quote-unquote Houston Chronicle. And when he gets there, he ends up in the middle of all of the events and has a major PTSD meltdown and gets taken in by the elders into a sweat lodge and has this transformational experience. And it's going to be filmed in the spring of next year, and it will be our first adventure into that world. And I think, you know, I'm sure it will have its challenges, but nothing can be harder than making documentaries. You know, between the two of us, we've got the skill set to make this work and make a film that's really powerful about something that's deeply personal for a lot of people.
Boy, it sure sounds like it. And you have just, between the two of you, created the most wonderful dynamic relationship that goes so far beyond your personal lives. I think it's just fabulous. I mean, the world needs more Rebeccas and Joshes. Rebecca, you and your husband set the bar pretty damn high. I think it's just fabulous. And your work is cut out for you. You'll never not have projects.
Well, you know, we have a joke that's days till bankruptcy, as you know, it's a producing documentaries, so I'm always counting how many days until we run out of money. And for the last few years, it's been months and months, which has been a good thing for us. And we've been, you know, I met him 12 years ago, and we've been living together now for 10, married for 8. And it gets better and better and easier and easier. So this is definitely, sometimes we scratch our heads and we say, you know, what would we do if we didn't do this? And we have lots of ideas, but we always come back to this because this is just what we both love.
Documentaries may not have the same sexiness that a narrative does, but these are important films. And thank you for your commitment, you and your husband, and for all you're doing. And not only thank you for that, thank you for joining me today. This was a fascinating conversation, and I wish you much more continued success. And it's been my pleasure and my honor to get to know you.
I'm honored to be here talking to you as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Nobody but a man.